and grateful to the Honourable Member, the Honourable Danny Peter. Madam Speaker, I have lost this year of my party as it is last year to pull together some of the themes that we have highlighted in this year's debate and respond where relevant to some of the speeches from the government side. And this is the last thing that I've ever said, that this has been a well-conducted debate. That the speeches that I have heard from the other side, while not agreeing with a lot of what has been said, I want to congratulate certainly some of the ministers, in particular Minister Castells and also Minister Gerstein, indeed the Deputy Chief Minister, for concentrating on the policy and what varies in their ministries have done, rather than attempt to denigrate, as it has been perhaps a hallmark in the past, and indeed of some other ministers, denigrate what has been done by this side when we were in government over 15 years. And in that regard, Mr. Speaker, I cannot speak in the same time about the departmental, and I certainly cannot speak in the same time about the Minister Insular, and I will have something to say about his contribution in due course. I start my contribution by making a number of general observations. By way of context on the debate on the state of our public finances, our differences with the government are not just about transparency and about accountability. These are issues that are most readily understood by members of the public in what is a very difficult debate to follow. But it's not more than that, Mr. Speaker. It's about being able to support existing or indeed emerging financial problems so that can be dealt with before they get out of hand. It's about protecting future generations of libertarians against the pitfalls, or economic pitfalls, I should say, burden and debt, and the consequences of unaffordable recurrent expenditure. The more it is in the moment, Mr. Speaker, that not everything is or can be about today. Debt mounting and out-of-control expenditure is all deferred or future taxation or cuts in public services or both. Since we started the water, we have been on an upward curve for the last 30 years. Does not mean that the trend will or indeed can continue. Neither can we lose sight of the very peculiar fight that we face as a community. The current government, Mr. Speaker, is a continuous thorn in our side, no matter how much goodwill flows from this side of the frontier in the form of what we believe is an outrageously one-sided tax agreement. It's more widely and makes a sensible threat to our economic model in 2016. I personally stand by that statement. That we will adapt. Absolutely we will adapt. But to adapt, we need time, we need patience, and we will not be painless, Mr. Speaker. In a community where our standard of living has suffered over the last 30 years, will people be prepared to take a hit on their standard of living if the risk that the government is undoubtedly taking with our public finances does not go to plan? What about the people who are already finding it difficult to cope now, who find it difficult to make ends meet? They're the ones who will suffer the most if the risk that they have taken backfires. On many occasions, I have warned of not taking things for granted, of the curve up ahead. I have been the Jeremiah to their fair Christmas, Mr. Speaker. Warned that it's not just the government that needs to change its mindset, unpopular as that may be with the community. That the community needed to recalibrate our expectations. In the frame that I dislike more than the any other that I have heard as a government minister or a member of the opposition. that, and it is something they have got to end. In Bermuda, Mr. Speaker, where governments there made the very limit, much as they have done in 2016, those auctions reached such levels that their governments ended up borrowing to pay for the current expenditure, Mr. Speaker. A strong economy, sound public finances, money is about to see a few difficult times, a point to which I shall return during the course of this speech. Those are the two foundations of a successful and indeed fair society. That is the way to protect the humanitarian way of life. Our public services and ordinary working class people. They are the core founding principles of the Gibraltar Socialist Labour Party, and they are the principles that the people, Mr. Speaker, that are in danger of being betrayed by the foreign government.
He is listening to this interview on the radio.
new Friday broadcast, Mr. Speaker. I will be making a bill, I put it. I will be making a bill. I will confirm to the deputy executive that I will be offering myself up as a candidate. I also know there will be those who see and who want to see the back of me who will be disappointed that they will have to wait another 10 years. End quote. Well, Mr. Speaker, let me tell the father of the house, the architect of rural economic policy, from the bottom of my heart, Mr. Speaker, that no one here on this side of the house wants him to leave politics or not to put his name forward as a candidate in our election.
Precisely the same point that he made in 2011.
7, but on a massive scale compared to the systematic engineering of our public finance, it's huge for government-owned companies. Companies that are not only republican or off-balance sheet debt, but are used, Mr. Speaker, to pay for expenditure that would otherwise come from government revenue. In 2010, long ago the leaders of opposition has pointed out, he said that every man, woman, and child was maximally indebted to the tune of £16,000. By the new measurement today, stands at £40,000, 250% more than when he made the point in 2010. Indeed, the difference of the speaker is that he is now limited. Particularly when you have a significant checkbook to back you up. no self-respecting opposition. No self-respecting leader of your position is bigger. You're praying to reduce his job or his or her job if it didn't point to these inherently contradictory and hugely flawed positions which the party bureaucracy has held on these issues. And the natural consequences of what they are doing with what they are doing with the public finances, Mr. Speaker, is that the numbers speak for themselves. The numbers do not speak for themselves, Mr. Speaker. They don't, and that is precisely why on this side of the House we are not voting in favour of a budget. In 2011 and 2015, they failed to tell the electorate that their spending would be underpinned by critical changes to allow him, the Chief Minister, to continue with his open textbook policy. During the 2011 general election, they did not tell people that they intended to amend the Gibraltar Savings Bank Act in order to allow us to move from a position where the Gibraltar Savings Bank could only invest the focus of the venture in the cash or cash equivalent, very safe forms of investment of investment into anything that the government wanted the Gibraltar Savings Bank to invest. Mr. Speaker, it was that amendment in March 2012, then 3 months after the 2011 general election, which allowed them to use hundreds of millions of pounds of saved money to invest in credit finance company limited, and from there into loans to third parties, or to pay for the communication of civil service. And I'm sorry, Mr. Speaker. Payments which are not reflected in this book, but which would have had the effect of increasing government expenditure or reducing or wiping out the surplus. At the time that he was calculating, Mr. Speaker, against government in 2011 for a record debt, or so he said, he was already planning to borrow and spend even more than we had done. But the difference was that he was not going to borrow directly, he was going to do it using the proceeds from the diversity of the bank through a line of government owned companies, Mr. Speaker. This is why, Mr. Speaker, contributions. I am referring to facts, however uncomfortable that makes honourable members opposite. These are facts, Mr. Speaker. These are people of the honourable constituency matters, Mr. Speaker, as to who is right and who is wrong in relation to this particular idea. Government revenue is paid to the IDF in Kitty-Akawit, the government pays for projects, went down from £181 million in 2012 to an actual of £53 million last year. £181 million in 2012 to £53 million last year. And with all the government developments that have been to go since 2012, contributions to those projects directly from the government have gone down, it hasn't gone up, Mr. Speaker. And the reason is that it's all been funded through borrowing and government and companies, which is not accounted for in this book, Mr. Speaker. And the numbers are not reflected in this book, Mr. Speaker. The same purpose has been the extreme re-engineering, Mr. Speaker, of our public finances in order to allow you to stand up every year and say, look what a financial miracle that I have presided over, and to still defend, Mr. Speaker, from criticism, bearing in mind the discourse in 2010 to 2011 about government debt and about government spending, Mr. Speaker. You repeat that process a few months after the 2016 general election. But I expect it to be amazing and increasing the legal borrowing limit to allow it to borrow potentially even more. The same amendment which the leader introduced has led to spiraling debt problems in that jurisdiction. If I ask members of the public this question, what's the past opposite? I've told people at the last election that the legal borrowing limits, the limits of how much the government could borrow, were going to be amended after the election, not after the election. Too often, that the answer by most right-minded statements and people in voting is, of course, what we have disclosed during the general election. What worse is that in this case, Mr. Speaker, during that general election, we have made public debt an electoral election, and they never said we are not going to defend the levels of public debt, but we are going to change the legal borrowing limit because we want to borrow more. That's what you're going to see for them to have said at the last election, Mr. Speaker. Not only do we think that public debt is low, but we are going to change the legal borrowing limit to allow to borrow more. We do that. I know that the people, that these ideas are very often turned into political points for the exercise, but it's not about that, Mr. Speaker. We are entitled to refer to those contributions and then ask the question, do you really trust them, Mr. Speaker, in the management of one of the fundamental pillars of our economy? And the resounding answer to that question in the light of that record that I have outlined is a resounding no. What has been the consequences of all this, Mr. Speaker? What have been the consequences of all this? The more interrupted, the more I'm enjoying it, I have to say. Apart from the issues that divide us about whether the debt mounting in government-owned companies should be considered public debt, or whether what the amount spent for government-owned companies is truly government expenditure, or whether this book is only half the picture, there are some very serious long-term issues at stake here. I understand the view of the government that debt could stay not bad, and I do on this side of the house. I've often expressed the view that without debt, we would live in the equivalent of a stone age. And I do say, it is a draw by an expectation, which is barely 2 weeks ago, I think, that a different view on the dangers of public debt. And in the short run, I think that it's good. It's a good way for countries to get extra funds to invest in their economic growth. In order to prevent a recession post the 2007 collapse in the banking sector. When you correct the public debt improves the standard of living of a country. Also, because it allows the government to go new roads to improve education and job training, which drives citizens to spend more now and spending further boost economic growth. But debt can also be a millstone that impacts not just on today's generation of taxpayers, Mr. Speaker, but can also affect future generations in a small community, and it can be very dangerous. When debt starts approaching significant levels, Mr. Speaker, investors usually start demanding higher interest rates. We know that over 3 years, the government has already paid £34 million in interest on a £300 million loan. We don't know the extent of that interest in relation to that loan and the other so-called investments that the government has made, because we do not have the necessary people in order to be able to make that judgment. But at a time, Mr. Speaker, when we're also having to reposition our economy, when we face the largest challenge that we have the debate on debt from other parts of the public finances. What about the father of the house said? Well, in Japan, there is a debt-to-savings economy ratio of 250%. In the United Kingdom, it's also very high, and in the United States. But we are not Japan. We are not the United States. We are not the United Kingdom. We are a very small community, Mr. Speaker, with a small economy by comparison. There are four factors, Mr. Speaker, that are relevant when we consider this aspect of the debate. There is debt, Mr. Speaker, there is tax, there is recurrent expenditure, and there is recurrent revenue. Debt, Mr. Speaker, has gone up massively, as I said, 260-240% since they were elected in 2011. I'm talking about gross debt, including the debt in government-owned companies. Recurrent expenditure has increased by 177%, Mr. Speaker. The government has gone down from 234 million in 2012 to 120 million today. We don't know what the tax position is in government-owned companies because they don't do not have that in that people. But neither debt, Mr. Speaker, nor current expenditure is likely to go down in the short to medium term, Mr. Speaker. Simply, that was admitted by the Honourable, the Father of the House. Then we were left with recurrent revenue, and recurrent revenue, the Father of the House pointed out, that's a good figure. Income duty, which is 25% of recurrent revenue, Speaker. 25%. The bulk of which is tobacco revenue. What will the Father of the House say? That's not likely to be going up in the future. It may even come down in the future, Mr. Speaker. Then we are left with income tax and corporate tax. And the overall value gaining companies, small value gaining companies, the reality is that the contribution to corporate tax and the contribution to income tax from gaming companies represent the bulk of that contribution, Mr. Speaker. In 2002-2003, the gaming sector not doing their towards the gaming sector. That is fair. The gaming sector has contributed to that industry. By which I mean that today it can be in Gibraltar, tomorrow can be somewhere else, Mr. Speaker. And therefore, when you actually consider those four components, you cannot directly feel the debate on debt from the other components, Mr. Speaker. Because if our recurrent revenue goes down, you are then left with new debt, new recurrent expenditure, Mr. Speaker, and then you are left in a very difficult position to say the least. In the context of assessing risk that could create a severe financial crisis, the U.S. Financial and Fiscal Responsibility Panel said this, Mr. Speaker. I quote, "Of greatest concern is the certainty of the island's shrinking workforce and a rapidly aging population. This will put ever-increasing pressure on both taxes and spending. On present trends, Bermuda is heading for a downward spiral of demographic and economic decline. The high level of government debt, unfunded pension liabilities, and other continuing liabilities leave the island extremely vulnerable. Deficit and debt reduction must therefore remain a high priority." The panel then also expressed concern as to vulnerability for outside forces. Quote, "Any shock that has a significant negative impact on Bermuda's economy could trigger a fiscal and financial crisis. Improving fiscal resilience by pursuing fiscal balance and debt reduction therefore should remain an overriding priority." End quote. I believe, Mr. Speaker, that high debt leads to high deficit, but in turn results in long-term and unemployment, with future government. government attempts to correct the position. In some countries, unfortunately, an entire generation has been thrown on the scrapheap to Europe rather than an attempt to balance the books after overspending and over-leveraging their public borrowing. Unsurprisingly, that has led to the rise of populist parties on both the left and also the right, Mr. Speaker. Austerity, aimed to reduce the dangers of debt default, has rendered politics dangerous instead, and I believe contributed to Brexit, where working class people in the North East and elsewhere felt disenfranchised and sick to the teeth of the poverty and uncertainty that austerity has brought. In simple terms, I believe that we are taking risks that we should not be taking, and that we cannot accept that risk because of the way that they have chosen to manage the finances of this community. If we are wrong, Mr. Speaker, if we are wrong, let the government open its book, all its books, including the accounts of government-owned companies, be open to the opposition. Let it have a public account. Where money is is no object without tempering that with everything else we have been saying from this side of the house, then using that ordeal with this or that part of the public service, you are going to have other parts of the public service wanting part of the action which is being done. That's the reality. You are also in a situation where enforcing government, makes it more difficult for workers to accrue their rights as before the increase in the qualifying period with latency regulations from 12 weeks to 52 weeks, simply because the government wanted to avoid deploying so many actions in the public service directly employed by them, Mr. Speaker. And they have the audacity, they have the audacity to say, that is the father of the House said in answer to my question 2 weeks ago, that it was all done for their benefit. Well, look, I suppose that the proliferation of our conflict was also for the benefit of all those workers out there that are being exploited on their own country. And in this country, Mr. Speaker, the new budget will say that we're now going to be abolishing the Swedish derivation. And we're going to be making it possible for people who are in a post with permanent civil service, the public service counterpart, we're going to make it easier for them to apply for them to be doing permanent. Because they don't realize, and I don't know what a real communication between themselves and the father of the house. But this is not real. I think this is a possible solution. There is a contradiction. Bear in mind what you have said about your current expenditure. Exploitation of the people cannot be justified. Looking at the charity, five people in the school sick, what am I going to say to Gibraltar? Not least because it doesn't take into account the people that are in Europe are in contact, which of course they're not in full set of hours in England, because you are as and when contact. If somebody can be employed, they're of course not be working because they're not required to work under the contract with the employer. And unless you have a full transparency in relation to that, and the role of the National Statistics Office provides you with those statistics, each of these things is going to result. Unless you have that, you cannot say what the two levels of unemployment is going to be. Two levels of unemployment.
And there was also a number as well
gave you shelter and plenty of food.
Which
opposition, Mr. Speaker, because I wasn't in opposition when that meeting happened. That meeting was actually quite recent. And the list was just in 2000. I'm talking about 2007, 2008, 2009, when it was not a great deal of the party. So, if it was a great deal of the party, at least we must not talk in the way of the story.
Of the FSC. Time they were called for many years, a time of fighting
kind of relevant and distinctive or defined as the CEO. In other words, the authority was the Financial Services Commission. The authority was the person that led the Financial Services Commission. That person was appointed by the Foreign Office. And the reason why the authority was the person, the CEO of the Financial Services Commission was, of course, that by appointing that person to let the FCO have some measure of control and influence in relation to the Financial Services Commission. That continues to be the position way into the DOD government's first term, and that legislation was changed. It's about time now, he said, in the development of the water and its people, that we have a local leading representative. I now turn to the contribution of Mr. Sacramento. I was probably short, Mr. Speaker, because the Honourable Mr. Yama has made just the only point that I wanted to make in response to the Honourable Lady. Honourable Lady said that the first time that game was mentioned, the first time that there was an advance on gay rights was when they were elected into government. The two governments that introduced a bill that equalized the age of consent, and that is, yes, that is no, Mr. Speaker, it was not a private member's bill. Point of order, I was requiring substance for when I began. I was a member of the opposition then, and as good a job as Albert Easter has, and he was a member of the opposition, probably not as good as Albert Easter has done, because Albert is well known as a Republican and a magnificent Calvin fan, and was an opposition. But the time that I was there, I remember this was a problem in the bill. You will recall that the issue that we had was that we believed that this would not be a government bill, that this would be a government bill, this would be a government bill, and I was still, in fact, I'm not going to use the committee on this subject. But I had to look at that. Well, the issue is that a problem in the bill must be paid by the member who promotes it, not by the government. Otherwise, it's not by the member. And I also got a text on that, and as usual, I got the level of transparency, I usually got MKA nothing.
Equalization. That is precisely what happened, Mr. Speaker.
would have done so also, Mr. Speaker. and Mr. Speaker and Mr. Speaker. That is our commitment, because we, Mr. Speaker, are prepared to set aside our differences for the sake of the voter. But what we are not going to do, Mr. Speaker, is to provide them with political cover for their failings, for their lack of accountability, and for their lack of transparency, Mr. Speaker. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The honourable member cannot deny that it has been a catalyst. A catalyst is something which speaks out a chemical reaction. The honourable Marlene Hassan.
Mr. Speaker, the last 4 years have afforded me the great privilege of serving the people of this community and help them with their issues and concerns. The nature of my political views and the platform me and my team have created throughout this legislature have allowed me to develop a very clear support with a growing electorate, one that is profoundly dissatisfied with the direction this community is taking and the fragging of a stagnant, ineffective political ecosystem. Many times I have tried to be a fierce advocate for their views in this Parliament, providing ideas and alternatives in the field of general policy, but also highlighting the systemic flaws that plague our young democracy. This is what I bring to you today, Mr. Speaker, the voices of many libertarians who have overcome their fear to stand up to the status quo, who are crying out against problems ranging from the general mismanagement of everyday affairs to the pressing need for systemic reforms that have become painfully evident. This voice is strong, clear, and irrepressible, and is once again acquiring the power and historical significance it has had many times in the past. As a community, when confronted with every significant challenge and defining crossroad, we have had the audacity to put our differences aside and raise our demands with a single, clear voice. We have had political leaders with vision and a commitment to the people, but those that lead us today clearly lack. On every one of these junctures, we have told the world, both inside and outside Gibraltar, that there is only one political agenda that binds and unites our forces, and that nothing will break this resolve. This agenda is the survival and the prosperity of the Gibraltar community, and its values of autonomy, national identity, and self-determination. I am here to tell this government on behalf of my party, Together Gibraltar, and all those we represent, that it is clear to us that this covenant has been broken. Measures have been taken that do not represent the best interests of the Gibraltarians, but the agenda of an economic elite. We are no longer one United Gibraltar, but two. The Gibraltar that benefits from luxury development and tax avoidance schemes, and the Gibraltar that toils in debt, pollution, and overwhelming living conditions. Our cityscape being transformed for the sake of an economic growth that many in this community are simply not partaking in a way that is impacting negatively on the quality of life of almost everybody in this community. Amidst the rubble of building sites, deepening traffic congestion, toxic air, and growing political and economic instability, many Gibraltarians are asking themselves, what on earth is all this for? How is this making our lives any better? What will be left of our way of life, and most importantly, our quality of life, once this vision has materialized? Who will benefit from this? Who is accountable for the blatant duplicity? Where is the new dawn of accountability and transparency through autonomy? The people of Gibraltar do not want to go down this path, Mr. Speaker, and they are telling us loud and clear world, but with one single agenda: the survival of our identity and the well-being of our people. People. On the economy, Mr. Speaker, in my path towards becoming a better public servant, I will have to dig deep, study, and investigate in order to arrive to an understanding of the issues that would allow me to make the right choices for the people of Gibraltar. These decisions and policy suggestions have always occurred within a framework of constant dialogue and communication with my constituents, and I believe it is a fundamental duty for every politician to be accessible and listen closely to the concerns of those who serve and whose interests we must look after. Unfortunately, the line of communication with this government, particularly on economic matters, has not been quite as smooth. This government has not published its accounts since 2015, till earlier this month, May 2019. I received a copy of the latest accounts for 2016, 2 weeks ago. The date on the principal auditor's report was the 29th of January, 2019, to speak, and this even improved. I was personally checked on the website on a regular basis, and it was only in the last few weeks that these accounts have been available to the public. This government has not disclosed any credible reason for the fact that these accounts were not published earlier. Today, I am compelled to ask our Chief Minister, as our Minister responsible for finance, if he can explain to the people of Gibraltar why the publishing of these accounts has been delayed. Just to clarify further, Mr. Speaker, Section 52(1) of the Public Finance Control and Audit Act 1977 states, quote, "The accounts shall show within a period of 9 months, or such longer period as the Minister responsible for finance shall allow, after the close of each financial year, sign and submit to the principal auditor accounts showing fully the financial position of the government of Gibraltar at the end of such financial year." Unquote. And can the Chief Minister confirm that the accounts showing fully the financial position of the government of Gibraltar have been transmitted to the principal auditor for the last 2 years, i.e., 2017 and 2018? And if not, Mr. Speaker, may I ask why? Is it for lack of resources, or is it for the convenience of keeping the people of Gibraltar in the dark? Based on the expenditure seen in this year's budget book, it is not due to lack of resources, Mr. Speaker. The first step towards transparency and accountability, things this government fervently promised, is to publish forthcoming and timely public accounts and actions of such will soon be raised out about the management of public funds. I understand that Brexit has brought about uncertainty, but not having a clear picture of Welsh communities and Welsh communities' public finances stand has fully added to this uncertainty. Further, it is interesting how the Honourable Minister for Global Finance appears to be trying to fend off future criticism without actually addressing the issues. What is more troubling is that this has now become an annual affair. We would expect the Minister for Economic Development to oversee a sustainable economy. When the economy is at risk, I would expect him to act by curtailing spending rather than maybe continue to highlight the issues, only so he can set up a later date. He sounds like he is in opposition, Mr. Speaker. Perhaps he is preparing. Mr. Speaker, the budget debate is always fertile ground to take stock of economic affairs. It is a chance to discuss the direction that we are taking and whether enough is being done to successfully manage our economy and what our businesses plan for the future. A future that is now all the more difficult to ascertain due to the impending Brexit. It is also a time to review our priorities and ask ourselves whether we have got these right. To follow are areas of concern that need to be addressed by this House, given its role as guardians of the people's interests. It now appears clearer than ever that our system of government lacks appropriate checks and balances when it comes to our public finances. the government's promise of a new dawn of transparency and accountability after two legislatures and almost a decade in power has clearly not been delivered. There is great anxiety within our business communities, and due to this lack of transparency, it is possible that our public finances are not being managed responsibly. One of my main concerns relates to government-owned companies. I ask the Chief Minister to explain the following. Mr. Speaker, after careful investigation, it has come to my attention that the number of government-owned companies has been growing in the last few years. On average, a sum of £25 million has been appropriated for government-owned companies. I also understand that these government-owned companies have not published and perhaps do not have to publish their financial accounts. Some of these companies have not filed a breached account since the days of the GST deal administration. The filing of a breached account is well known to be a statutory requirement for limited companies. Is it possible that companies that are government-owned should be treated differently to companies that are privately owned? Is there a special dispensation for this? As far as my constituents are concerned, many of whom are company owners, there are obligations for a limited company to file annual abridged accounts. Is this not the case for wholly government-owned companies? Mr. Speaker, I refer to the list of 34 such companies that are listed in the draft revenue and expenditure book. What is the justification for all of these government-owned companies? Is each company carrying out a different role? It appears that a number of them are property-holding companies. Is it not possible to have just one company that holds all the properties? Indeed, can anyone in this House explain the need for the growing number of government-owned companies that no information is published in? Who has overall responsibility for these companies, and who signs the accounts of these companies, if anyone does? Mr. Speaker, this is all the more concerning when a number of these companies are now big tenants and doing business in the private sector. Some of these companies, and some of these government-owned companies, are estimated to be turning over millions in revenue and expenditure. We, the public, have a right to know, given that the companies are owned by the people of Gibraltar. And carrying on the theme of government-owned companies, I understand that there is a mortgage or charge over the main government-owned company called Gibraltar Investment Holdings Limited of an unlimited amount. This charge has been in place since the 7th of April 2016. Would the Chief Minister please explain why the charge has to be unlimited, and does this mean that in effect all companies owned by this main holding company are also covered by this mortgage? Would it be possible to know whether this charge is related to the mortgage in a Gibraltar housing estate? And if so, how much has been borrowed by government in terms of this mortgage? Mr. Speaker, another issue with transparency is the tender system. I understand that a new procurement system has been set up for the purposes of obtaining quotations and having a more efficient tendering process. Many of my constituents feel that this system is not offering them any particular advantage. There are concerns in the community that many of the requests, and certainly the larger tenders, are being allocated to the usual suspects yet again. Just like the project at Catalan Bay Parking Lot, where it happened that my partner discovered that a developer was already pre-selling apartments even before the expression of interest answer was published in the Gibraltar Chronicle. This is just one of many examples of poor governance over the tender system. Last year, Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Sir Joseph Farmer, Minister for Economic Development, Telecommunications and the GSP, stated that the rate of public expenditure of his government was not sustainable. In his words, he said that on average, public sector earnings are 25% higher than the UK equivalent and 50% higher than the average earnings in Gibraltar's private sector. In the same week, he said that there was no need to consider austerity in order to address the issue. Mr. Speaker, given that the public sector, both the civil service and the GDP, together now cost in the region of £25 million a month, or £300 million per annum, in just salaries alone, and that there appears to be no intention to scale back the size of the public sector, many stakeholders in the public sector are asking questions as to the sustainability of this rate of expenditure. The Chamber managed to get spring stuff, many need for a much more attractive government loan. In fact, it is now believed that some business owners are now very keen to join the civil service. But seriously, Mr. Speaker, the average wage in the public sector is now 50% higher than that in the private sector. And the public sector have much better conditions of work to boot. The aspiration, therefore, for many of our youth is now to become government employees. This kind of expectation does not bode well for the entrepreneurial spirit that you both have always had. And also, it would detract from a longer-term vision that is required for the prudent management of our economy, because inflating the public sector at the expense of the private sector will only create an economic dependency, which in the long run is simply unsustainable. This does not mean that we do not need that we need to apply strict austerity policies or downscale our civil service. Rather, that we should rationalize our spending and invest in those key sectors that will guarantee the functioning of our administration and the fulfillment of our economic plans. This means investing heavily in those sectors that provide real quality of life and opportunity for our communities, such as the health sector, in which external recruitment agencies are offering short-term contracts and undercutting wages, diluting the workforce and shutting out the employees who are contracted centrally. Furthermore, this policy might undermine our ability to continue giving these quality public services in the medium to long-term future as privatization and budget cuts are getting in the way of continuity and sensible succession planning. In other strategic areas, such as education, civil servants are complaining about stagnant wages and suboptimal working conditions. This is something I will elaborate in detail when addressing the education portfolio. We are offloading the care of our elderly to de facto subsidiary companies, whose employees suffer from low wages and poor working conditions. De facto privatization of the care centers, together with the general policy of reducing costs by privatization of key sectors of public service, is damaging the morale of workers. Across the board, there are more positions taken by recruitment companies with work on limited contracts, while the worker who has done their hours for several years may still be on temporary contracts when they should be made permanent. To make classes work, this privatization process has been executed in a manner that is less than transparent, something that seems to be a constant in the dealings of this administration, which further raises concerns as to the motivation behind this dramatic policy turn by a socialist government in Maine. Mr. Speaker, another element contributing to the lack of motivation within the civil service is the current government's trend to hire retired public sector workers who already enjoy hefty pensions and final salary payments for top positions within the civil service. This seemingly arbitrary position sends out the message to prospective clients that the top positions within the public sector are reserved for a class and is therefore inaccessible to those from outside the establishment. Also, it is not surprising that those currently employed and working hard in the hope of fair chance of promotion are reporting low motivation and low levels of job satisfaction. Further, many promises have been made to private sector pensioners, but very few have been delivered. While it is important to welcome the progress made for those at the bottom of the income bracket, it is important that we don't allow those who have contributed to the growth of our private sector, from which, let's not forget, we fund most of our public spending, to retire on what is effectively a subsistence wage and expose to whom we owe an important part of our current prosperity to substandard living conditions. It seems clear to me that the solution to these imbalances is not only the rationalization of the private sector, but also the improvement of working conditions in the private sector. Models such as more transparent and competitive relationships between the public and the private sector, coupled with meaningful consultation on real increases in the minimum wage in line with local living costs, not of the symbolic kind, as we have seen in the Chief Minister's on both stakeholder business communities and providing the necessary support to guarantee the survival and prosperity of our small business ecosystem. This is an issue that I would like the Chief Minister to address and hear what he's talking about. Mr. Speaker, on another note, following on from what Minister Isola said yesterday with reference to the permanent contract awarded to the Royal Cavalry for Post Office workers, many of whom were on supply contracts for years, I represent a district of employees for the last 18 months in my capacity as a member of this House. I would therefore like to express my sincere gratitude to the Minister and the Chief Minister for receiving us in their offices on several occasions and listening to their concerns and their realities, culminating in the award of their permanent contract. I am very grateful to Minister Isola and the Chief Minister for their time, attention, and leadership on this matter, Mr. Speaker, and for both these gentlemen's willingness to collaborate with a member from across the House in a constructive and positive spirit for the ultimate benefit of a much deserving collection. Mr. Speaker, hand in hand with the public sector is to go to the pension issue. We are aware that current demographic trends dictate that pension expenditure can only go up, but we have a serious imbalance in our system that needs to be addressed. The other day, I met with a constituent who has to survive on £145 a month. That is the extent of her pension. The Speaker, even you have to agree that this is near impossible to survive on such a meagre pension in this day and age. Our understanding is that the pension system and the general welfare system that we have in Gibraltar is there to serve all citizens and take care of them fairly, as well as providing a safety net that prevents those more vulnerable from living in undignified conditions. Only recently did members of the Private Sector Workers and Pensioners Association take to the streets of Gibraltar to demonstrate in response to the broken campaign commitments of this administration over their last 2 terms of office. These commitments were clearly defined in this government's manifesto and subsequent communications, and to this day continue to be nothing but empty promises. We believe a more supportive stance is required in this area, and certainly a much more constructive approach. The Private Sector Workers and Pensioners Association have lobbied and campaigned for over a decade, and have always supported them in their demands for dignified living pensions. It is an absolute ethical necessity that the promises made to our elderly on this issue are honored. This is expected made up of old age pensioners, our parents and grandparents. They are people who have worked tirelessly to build our nation and our economy, who have contributed beautifully to the common pot, and who now feel cast aside by their institutions and their people. On the matter of cost of living, the growth of the economy, we are told by the Honourable Chief Minister, is booming, that incomes are rising and our standard of living is on the up. But that is not what my constituents are telling me. They complain about stagnant wages, rising living expenses, and more precarious working conditions. I am now more convinced than ever that this government has not any sense of priority in this matter and is way out of touch with the average member of this community. Mr. Speaker, upon turning to the housing portfolio, I must first take this opportunity to thank the Honourable Minister Samantha Sacramento for making herself available to me whenever I have brought to her constituents to a good deal. However, Mr. Speaker, I have to bring to your attention that as an independent member of this House who shadows all portfolios and has seen hundreds of constituents in the year alone, the bulk of the issues that land on my desk are those relating to the housing portfolio. As of this week, Mr. Speaker, according to the Action for Housing representatives we have spoken to, there are over 650 individuals or families on the waiting list for one-bedroom homes. Some of the people who are on this list have been waiting for a government-rented home for over 5 years. Despite calls by industry experts in housing, there is a massive shortfall in the stock of affordable rental accommodation, and those in need of these affordable homes are finding themselves squeezed out of a housing market that is plagued with bad practices and is becoming severely bloated and ineffective. Out in have made it impossible. Documented positive effects, as we know from countries that have adopted such legislation. that is what I call real equality in this decision, and nothing else is it. Mr. Speaker, to sum up my observations on economic affairs, I would like to advocate for a bolder vision for our economy. Most of our economy is sustained by a small number of key sectors, some of which have come under attack in recent years. It is therefore important that we make sure that we are not excessively reliant on any of these pillars, and that we diversify our economy enough to be able to withstand sudden change. The conditions of the recent tax treaty in Spain are arguably punitive, and the implications of this treaty are not yet being fully felt. If this is a sign of things to come, our financial sector might have to start operating under more stringent conditions, and our hard-earned status as a competitive, low-tax jurisdiction might become jeopardized. We have a gaming industry which has recently suffered the loss of their 365 jobs. We have a gaming industry that has recently suffered the loss of 500 jobs of their 365. That is despite assurances from both the company and Her Majesty's government that they will change. The loss of 500 jobs approximately is substantial. However, we are not aware of how many of these jobs were local to Ontario. Would the Chief Minister be able to confirm the numbers on this? The gaming industry has been a net provider to Gibraltar, but we need to be sure that these companies are committed to Gibraltar for the longer term. This is because everyone in Gibraltar knows that tourism is the one industry that we can really grow in, and one that is relatively free from external costs. Unfortunately, not enough is being done in this area, Mr. Speaker. A strategic plan is overdue. What kind of destination can we be, and what can we go to aspire to? These are questions that many have been asking in two terms of this current administration when they realize the true potential of our tourist product. I appreciate the skywalk and the suspension bridge, but there is so much more that needs doing, Mr. Speaker, in order to lure tourists looking for more than the basic tourist products that we have offered for many decades. The Port of Gibraltar should also become a major sector of our economy and one that we can operate and manage freely and independently of extraneous threats. Although it has seen improvements in recent years, I believe more needs to be done to improve and maintain this business, thus creating new and more sustainable economic pillars that can guarantee our autonomy and increase our economic resilience. Mr. Speaker, I now turn to the health portfolio and its issues. But before I immerse myself in this most vital portfolio, I would like to thank my good friend, the Honourable Neil Costa, Minister for Health, for always making himself available to me and my constituents so that I can help the people of this community. I appreciate the good work of the Honourable Minister opposite me, and that of his staff, from Evelyn Servan to Martin Alton and Carl Connor on the grassroots portfolio, who never fail me when it comes to assisting others. And I say this in particular because I find it crucial to highlight the excellent treatment on a human one-to-one level between a minister and the officials towards a member of the House and her constituents. However, Mr. Speaker, this welcome reality, sadly, does not differ from the systemic issues that I am duty-bound to highlight. Issues that, to my mind, are the most salient of questions from within the health authority. Mr. Speaker, it is unfortunate to have to report that the Gibraltar Health Authority, under a GSLP Liberal government, has seen the wealth morale of its employees in recent history. All this has proven that spirits are at an all-time low, with the exploitation of agency workers and the incidence of protests and high-profile tribunals just during power. The GHA has increased from 3 hours a huge part of our budget to help develop services across the globe, with Giron Salud taking a substantial sum of our referrals in place of investing more in facilities and humanitarian services. There are services which are hanging by a thread, Mr. Speaker. For example, the urological service, which has no adequate cover on most nights and has not even had a full-time consultant post occupied since March. Instead of investing on building our own self-sufficiency, we are, Mr. Speaker, managers are holding conflicting roles. This policy allocates a massive workload on a single person, but obviously a massive political tool. Again, substantive solutions are the cost of the public, Mr. Speaker. The administration of the affairs within the GHA sadly reeks of short-termism, with quick grasp measures being implemented to cut on expenditure, but at what cost, Mr. Speaker? In the 2015-16 budget speech, the GSLC Liberal government announced that its doctors would be validated by the greatly respected General Medical Council. A 2015 manifesto commitment. Shortly after them, I extensively quizzed the then Minister for Health, the Honourable John Bridges, on how the GSLC was going to work, with all the challenges that it would present. I was assured that all the mechanisms were firmly in place for a school to be fully functioning GMC funding. Since the implementation of the Medical and Health License Practice and Revalidation in 2014, government has failed to deliver a robust GMC structure locally. It only has failed that they have created loophole after loophole and increased the transition provision period for doctors who could not meet the requirements set out in the detail. Actually, additional provision for these doctors, was changed 3 times in 2016, again in 2017, 2 more times in 2018, and again this March 2019. A total of 7 changes and extensions to this rule. In almost 5 years, they have not been able to ensure that all of our doctors, inside and outside of the hospital, meet the standard. Moreover, we are paying out for a responsible officer who forms part of the clinical governance with a generous salary that the doctors and surgeons who will graduate without funding, for example, do not have to meet his GMC standards. This is because the things on us from Fox is fantastic and good. Some of the staff in these hospitals can't be guaranteed to speak English to our patients. In the end, all blame for any negligence or GMC unregulated practices in Spain. Our people, Mr. Speaker, that's it. The problem, are you comparing yourself? The problem here is misdistributed increases in personnel. Too many captains with questionable demeanors trying to run a hospital to the ground by exploiting the staffing levels. Zero our contract via agency workers whose bosses are massively enriching themselves and relying more and more on our neighbours instead of investing on our health service. On the bright side, Mr. Speaker, after extensive and careful discussions with the Health Minister on the topic of alopecia and the sufferers, an issue which I brought to him during the course of this year, I am proud to report that alopecia sufferers are now seeing the start of a policy which will support them through psychological support by counsellors recommended by the GHA dermatologist on diagnosis of the condition, as well as financial support for weeks, which is a crucial need for sufferers to maintain their dignity and high spirit in what is a life-changing condition. I thank the Minister for Health for this, for his empathy and for acting so quickly and diligently to the needs of a small number of people in our community who we may not have been made aware of until then. Father, Mr. Speaker, while I do appreciate the good work carried out by the Honourable Minister of Health on the portfolio of the elderly and dementia care, I have to highlight that we can do more, Mr. Speaker. I take the opportunity to congratulate Daphne Alcantara and the wonderful work she does with Dad. But, Mr. Speaker, we need our government to do so much more. Dementia is a worldwide epidemic. People are living longer, and the elderly are needing more care, more support. And if we don't have a long-term plan for them, we will be failing our most vulnerable. We owe it to our elders to ensure that we have a sustainable plan going forward which will secure their well-being and minimize their loneliness. And this includes assisted living in particular, which will allow people living with dementia to live at home for longer and have staff available to assist them 24 hours a day. And let's not forget, Mr. Speaker, that most of the residents in Montalbania have dementia. The place is old, it's in great need of repair, new beds, new facilities. Montalbania needs upgrading amenities person, it needs to be dementia friendly. The same as property that your site and your market is home. When will this happen? My vision for people living with dementia includes dining halls, social activities every day, not every now and then, where residents can gather if they wish to eat their meals and stimulate their minds and each other. Our employees deserve no less, Mr. Speaker. As we know, budgets are always priority-led, and when some administrations will prioritize development, capital projects, and construction, our parties are going to vote to commit to a cohesive, long-term care plan that will combine housing, support services, and healthcare in one's own home or apartment as a matter of extreme priority and urgency. And we shall be rolling out our policies to that effect in our upcoming electoral manifesto. On the topic of abortion, Mr. Speaker, I shall not elaborate today on the decision given that an amendment to the Crimes Act bill will be presented to the House imminently, and we will have time to debate it then. But I feel I must say during the course of this address that I commend government for bringing the bill to this House, albeit its essays late. I hope we can continue to treat women's sexual health as a women's health care issue when we will eventually learn as a society that not having pro-choice legislation does not actually stop abortion, but only stop safe abortion and stigmatizes those who want to exercise disparately recognized human rights. Despite the welcome advances brought forward by this legislation, I observed with great concern that on the 2nd of January this year, four male members from across the House signed an anti-choice petition aimed at stifling the realization of this long-overdue legislative change. This was presented by the Honourable Dr. John Cortez, MP, on behalf of the Honourable Mr. Albert Isola, with the support of the Honourable Mr. Daniel Peterson, and the Honourable Mr. Lindell.
And your anticipation is you're speaking about what you understand is a bill that the government is introducing later on in Parliament. Are you anticipating that when what we are discussing are the estimates of revenue and expenditure for this year? And also to highlight at this stage who signed and did not sign the petition that was tabled here some time ago. I honestly think that is beyond the limit of the proceedings this afternoon. I think so. I mean, it is something that you could well bring up. If the bill comes to Parliament, it is something that you can then well bring up during the course of your intervention. That's the proper procedure in my view.
There would be a dispute at the information. I understand the members did not sign it, they presented it for official. I'm afraid it would be a little bit that they signed if they had presented it, for sure, but before it was signed. So if it's a point of agreement across the board, then there is no point of order. And I think it may be helpful to the lady if I was to indicate to her that we have a very good opportunity to set out the overview in that respect. Very shortly in the House, so maybe in the interest to follow the Chair's advice in this respect, because I'm still interested about this, and to talk about the state of the nation as well, so that therefore to want to talk about other issues that are experienced, so I just invite you to pass me a point not about the bill. If you didn't talk about the bill, if you talk about abortion and the debate on abortion, if you didn't talk about the bill, then I think it's probably unsafe to say.
I retract where I said signed and then presented. I still wonder whether other members of the House have been allowed to go further than me discussing bills during the addresses that they have had, but I'm happy to leave it there. Speaker, on the matter of drug addiction, I challenge the Minister of Health, who is at the same time the Minister of Justice, something which is a convenience when addressing this particular issue. In the interest of social justice and also of the advancement of our community and the improvement of our social standards, I am on record for stating that small amounts of by helping others. And it is a concierge that is currently at working this stage within my party, with members comprising of law enforcement workers, staff strategy workers, and mental health professionals. Nevertheless, we have endured scathing remarks from the honourable member to my right, Lawrence Yamas of the GSD, going as far back as to ask me publicly to retract my party's policies, thus manifesting some worrying authoritarian tendencies. Only to open a court of a fired drug strategist advocating for decriminalization in Clayton, quite a credible Mr. Speaker. It was also only 2 weeks ago when I had a heated debate with the Chief Minister himself, who described my policy as dangerous. This is what I have to say to them both. What is dangerous, Mr. Speaker, is the lack of counselors while the Chief Minister announces 2 new positions when all government is doing is replacing 2 lost positions. What is dangerous is the breaking procedure introduces funds, both for detox and admission. What is dangerous is this government and GSD opposition discussions that are proposed to punish addicts and to rehabilitate them. What is dangerous is our juvenile prison and our supported state-of-the-art cycle-to-free program, which needs to cycle itself out of prison as fast as it can and be replaced. What is dangerous is children with criminal records that then preclude them from ever redeeming themselves and becoming upstanding citizens and job holders in later life. What is dangerous is having just one drug addiction doctor for our entire community. What is dangerous is having a place like Ocean View used for detoxification purposes, when what we need is a designated center for detoxification 24/7 instead of having to rely either on Ocean View or AME, which cannot cope with the patients and often have to come in on. I know this because I have lived this over and over with constituents who, after bravely trying to put an end to a lifetime of drug abuse, are left alone and lost with the door being literally slammed in their faces and a ghost of sensationalizing around the corner. What is dangerous is that apparently the city hall is used as an outpatient center. What is the message we are sending out to Mr. Speaker? What is dangerous is that after 3:30 p.m. one cannot find a drug outreach worker, let alone a weekend. What is dangerous is that the government's drug strategy dates from 8 years ago and in practice amounts to very little. Mr. Speaker, where are the experts and strategists? And these people, are they getting paid for their services? What experience do they have? Who are these consultants and why something for their services? What is dangerous is the lack of funds directed at the drug rehabilitation portfolio while we build property for the wealthy and allow the underprivileged to get thrown in jail and stigmatized for life. What is dangerous is Minister Costa saying one thing on decriminalization and the Chief Minister saying another. What is dangerous is the non-existent drug and alcohol workers who should be working alongside the police, including the police after the deceased. There is no arrest and referral, Mr. Speaker. Just a jail sentence and a vicious circle of petty crime and nothing else. What is dangerous is the lack of drug and alcohol workers within the care agencies and the court bodies. What is dangerous is having long walks into groups of farms, as well as no overall patient supervision or social views, leading to people to literally throw themselves out of their windows. Mr. Speaker, only yesterday, a painful video was doing the rounds via WhatsApp of one of our citizens begging government to be accepted to Bruce's farm after being turned away, warning anyone who cared to watch it as he was on the verge of suicide. The guy is not a testament to a failed drug strategy and failed mental health services, Mr. Speaker, said I honestly don't know what to do. What is dangerous is government boasting of this market for the people while our most vulnerable are denied elements of basic care and social support. Mr. Speaker, general mental health services and support are also sadly lacking. We are still failing on delivering a robust policy and framework that is meant to embrace the mental health sufferer and help them heal through easily accessible programs, services, and tools. Become mental health should be a priority for any government that wants to advance a society. Because a society without the adequate mental health support services is a broken society. Mr. Speaker, I spent much of my time nursing mental health patients during the week and on weekends, not enough. On the medicinal cannabis issue, Mr. Speaker, just over 2 years ago, I proposed a motion in relation to the provision of medicinal cannabis to suffering patients. My motion did not succeed. I didn't get one vote, and many in this House alluded to a lack of consensus in the medical literature to make that decision. Today, it seems like things have changed. Despite not having seen any major breakthroughs in investigations since then, suddenly the idea has become palatable to those same people. Coincidentally, the cannabis-derived industry is booming worldwide, generating huge profits for those who invest in the sector. It seems that it has been this, and not the suffering of patients, that has spurred this government into action on this issue, Mr. Speaker. It seems that my proposals, motivated exclusively by the advances in medicine and the needs of patients in severe distress, are no longer worthy of scorn. It seems to me that, once again, profit comes for well-being of people. In any case, if it means my constituents will get access to better medication, I welcome this development. Mr. Speaker, on justice. In reference to the justice portfolio, earlier this year, my party proposed a 4-point plan in relation to assisting families of victims of crime when the associated criminals are due to come out for parole. I believe it is vital to move on measures like the ones we propose in order to enfranchise victims and their families into the parole process. A caring community, and especially a small community, which is not anonymous like ours, needs directives in order to provide victims and their families the time and process they may deserve in advance of a convicted criminal coming out of jail. And I hope that our proposals or similar ones are adopted shortly, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, my party believes that Gibraltar's justice system needs to serve the people of Gibraltar. It must be fair, accessible, and enjoy the confidence of everyone. In legislating on justice matters, we will ask of any proposals, will it increase fairness? Will it make the system more accessible? Will it improve confidence in the system? Mr. Speaker, we have to be honest about the system's failings. There is community disquiet about our criminal justice system. Justice can be expensive, too expensive for those who need to access the system. We have also an obligation to be honest about what can be achieved. My party would propose the introduction of a conditional legal aid fund. The unfairness of both the criminal legal aid and civil legal assistance systems are well known and widely acknowledged. The eligibility threshold for legal assistance is so low as to make it worthless to most working Gibraltarians. The criminal system doesn't pay lawyers properly to defend cases. Too often, this government reform has centered around trying to squeeze more from the existing public care. My party, Mr. Speaker, believes that we need to be imaginative about this. There is a system that works in places like Hong Kong and Western Australia, places with a similar legal system to ours. It asks those who benefit from the system to contribute towards it, not bringing a new stream of funding into the system. We would look at how it can be introduced into voters as a matter of priority. Another issue that my party would address, Mr. Speaker, is that it's short-term judicial appointments. We consider it very harmful that judges are appointed on time-limited contracts. What legal practitioners would give up their practice, Mr. Speaker, if they might find themselves out of a job in 4 years' time? That is leaving aside the vulnerability to arguments that short-term appointees may not be properly independent. We will make sure that ordinary judicial appointments are made to the constitutional retirement age of 67. If the level of court business requires further judges, acting judges under Section 63 of the Constitution will be appointed rather than senior judges. Mr. Speaker, turning to the issue now of how we deal with crime in Gibraltar, in general, we are all thankful that Gibraltar is a low crime community. But we can't be complacent. It is easy for politicians to engage in get tough rhetoric. But how we keep people from getting involved with crime, Mr. Speaker, how we rehabilitate and punish those who do get involved, is too important to be left to party political games. Our party would look to establish a commission with experts and involvement in civil society to examine the issue of parole, sentencing, rehabilitation, and crime prevention in a holistic way and to advise Parliament. We will invite that commission around the world benefit from the wisdom of others. Another factor on which is God's grace on the wisdom of others is on the arbitration of commercial disputes, which is widespread. A number of international arbitration centers exist. A party would examine whether a government-sponsored arbitration center in Gibraltar would work to bring business to Gibraltar. We would also take steps to implement a government-sponsored mediation service for family and matrimonial disputes in order to assist separated couples to reduce the conflict and expense that almost inevitably accompany the breakdown of a relationship, both for them and crucially for any children of the relationship. Another issue that my party would address is that of how the disabled and elderly are accounted for within the social system. Mr. Speaker, it is important that we value every member of the community. Disabled people are entitled to the assistance they need to be able to participate fully in the life of the community. The elderly are entitled to the care they need to live with dignity, Mr. Speaker, and given enhanced safeguards that exist to protect the disabled or elderly people who lack capacity to take certain decisions for themselves. We will never subordinate respect for their independence or family life to administrative convenience. To the extent that their liberty needs to be restricted, we will look to ensure that that is subject to the approval of the court and enhance the right of family members to be involved in such proceedings. Mr. Speaker, the government must be congratulated for its recent proposals to reform our divorce laws in order that the focus of divorce proceedings ceases to be the striving of blame for one party or another. We wholeheartedly agree with the proposed reduction to the minimum period of marriage required prior to presenting a petition to divorce. Mr. Speaker, it is no secret that I am against the enlargement of Parliament in the way that it has been presented and with the little consultation we have been afforded. Having already made my case clear, I take this opportunity to ask the Chief Minister to continue to deliberate on this reform and not to rush into something which will substantially modify the Voltairean democracy for generations to come, so we can instead consult on it more widely in the following electoral term, when all parties can present clearly our own models for this fundamental change in our model of representation. Turning to education, Mr. Speaker, I firstly thank the very approachable Honourable Minister, John Fortson, who is always available to clarify matters and then to have his constituents who approach me in need of assistance. As for education in general, Mr. Speaker, this electoral cycle has possibly been one of the most stressful, disenchanted, and disruptive periods for teaching and for students in a very long time. Although there are things for which government must be credited, there are grave and concerning issues that have surfaced during this electoral cycle that cannot be ignored. Considering that this is likely to be the last party speech of the current cycle before the next general election, an evaluation of the current administration's track record in education since 2015 is a democratic necessity in order for the electorate to measure how much value has been earned in real terms to the education of our youth. Government must be congratulated for its substantial investment in educational infrastructure. The commitment to building a total of 8 new schools is something to be applauded, but many are asking themselves whether such an ambitious project needed to be undertaken in such a short period of time at the expense of the quality of teaching and learning in our schools. Teachers and students cannot perform at their best in times of great upheaval, and instead of recognizing this and mitigating the potential adverse effects of introducing co-education, aligning the key stages and moving to new students simultaneously, the government has chosen to ignore the concerns raised by teachers via their unions time and time again, and use the Department of Education and senior management to bulldoze ahead with their plans. This lack of consideration of and respect for the expert body of teachers as important as stakeholders in education is where much of the prejudice and contempt stems from. Cabinet Meadow and Bishop Fitzgerald will be rebuilt where they stand. In the interim, they will be relocated to the present St. Anne's and Bayside schools once again. These parties migrated to the new building at Woodham Waterfall, respectively. Plans to house Government Meadow School on the roof site as part of a wider project have been abandoned for reasons unknown. The Bayside St. strategy that the office is a priority. But it is also a priority in the 2050 manifesto, and not a single brick was made in over 3 years. It is disappointing to see the project being rushed to the detriment of many by a government that has clearly not prioritized the education of vulnerable children and are now opportunistically seeking to tick a box in their manifesto. The decision to co-locate Bayside and West Bedford on Waterport Road raised valid concerns from teachers and their unions. Many of the most educationally sound concerns remain unanswered and have been met with a wall of silence from the Ministry of Education and the Chief Minister. The message is really one of everything is under control, and we know what we are doing, so it will be okay. No amount of talking will fix the broken lines of communication until teachers can once again trust their government. I'm talking from the reaction of teachers at the first was outside on the 6th, where the Chief Minister was greeted with the front, no more lies. A lack of trust is more than evident and quite justified given recent events with PwC. The size of both of these schools should worry not just teachers, but parents alike. Over 2,500 students in a campus-sized megasite is contrary to what most educational experts would advise when constructing secondary schools. The trend is now to build smaller schools, where the student-teacher ratio is lower, leading to improved levels of teaching and learning, and where incidents of violence and or bullying can be identified and tackled more effectively than in a massive institution where the crowd can facilitate anonymity. However, once again, the government bulldozed their project forward without listening to teachers, because what matters are the release of land and commercial interests, and not the needs of our teachers and students in the state. What is the point in having two identical co-educational secondary schools side by side? Would it be logical to have two identical police stations or two identical hospitals next to each other? Of course not. But they could not build a single mega school after the political spin and passing machinery age, as described in the opposition's idea, only to the same result, could they? Thank you. Instead, if I can realize, instead, they are distorting it. Not to mention, Mr. Speaker, the discord with the purported environmental credentials of a government aiming to have a green agenda, while no doubt creating million protocols and major security issues in just under 300 souls will have to navigate daily to the same spot, an area where already there are several housing stations, a power station, an airport to start throwing waste, and a new housing estate recently announced about to be constructed. The mind boggles, Mr. Speaker, honestly, you just can't make it up. On the evening of the speaker and the other school children who were just about all be in the school simultaneously, I can tell you that mine and the similar concerns of hundreds of other mothers and fathers are very real indeed. In addition, Mr. Speaker, the government said that the competition that will arise between both schools as a result of their proximity will be a good thing. We believe that there is a real danger of one school adopting the practices and methods of the other as soon as it begins to lag behind in terms of performance to avoid the danger of the bad consequences. This is likely to kill the spirit of healthy competition. Considering the decision to align the two stages and introduce co-education, an alternative and logical solution would have been to have a lower secondary school, an upper secondary school, a sixth-form college, and in separate locations. That would have been a truly revolutionary move in education. A solution that was completely outside the box and which put teaching and learning fast and not into the speculation of instruction. Security in our schools is a very important issue where we hear government is failing. Education still does not have a zero tolerance policy, as with the Department of Education, very little has happened except for the addition of an extra educational advisor after reviewing the role of the junior educational advisor. The Department of Education is still not a policy-driven department, and the advisory team acts more like a legal officer than provide an advisory service. Their role is viewed by many teachers as one of enforcement rather than one of support. Whether that is the reality or not, that is the perception from a substantial number of teachers who we have spoken to. I bring in the voices of a substantial number of teachers and all subjects to clear that their members across the technology is truly afraid that they think they know better. Exactly. The staff of the Department of Education must remember its own teaching rules and begin acting like leaders and not managers. The status quo must change. The recent pay dispute is a complex issue, but since it has been said out in the media, there is little to infer. Teachers have made valid arguments, in our opinion, to have their basic salary adjusted to reflect their real and unseen workload, to close the salary gap with other similar professions in the water, and to be valued appropriately within a jurisdiction similar in economic prosperity to the water. It is clear from reading the exchanges in the media between government and the NASCWC that the percentage of thoughts are not as high as the government has endeavored to put into the public domain. Not only has the NASCWC demonstrated that the percentage of thoughts at each level of the basic salary scale are significantly lower, but they have highlighted the Chief Minister's own admission of having inflated civil service and public sector wages by as much as 40% above parity. Teachers are correct in feeling that the government treats their claim with disrespect and contempt when they see the inflated salaries of other public servants. Inflated with allowances and guaranteed overtime, which is irresponsible and unsustainable by our account. But having received others with such freebies, teachers now feel discriminated that they should bear the brunt of austerity measures. CWC orders the certain time for reasonableness. My party, Fidelity Water, would spend a sit with the representatives of our teaching professionals and iron out an agreement of mutual benefit. Valuing teachers without the need for backgrounds in the form of legal allowances or guaranteed overtime is paramount. Teachers do not want that. They want their salary to reflect their qualifications and their professional training, their seen and their unseen workload. They're important for our economy and their unwavering hard work in the academic and vocational training for our youth. On vocational training, Mr. Speaker, and education, and apprenticeship, the government's track record is simply abysmal. This, despite the Honourable Minister of Finance words during the Lombardy speech just 2 days ago, where he said, we will continue to provide apprenticeship and training. Mr. Speaker, I believe that on this rare occasion, I can speak for the entire side of this house and ask, where on earth is this taking place? Because we don't come find it, and neither can anyone else who is looking for it, Mr. Speaker. The system continues to fail for young people who are not academic, but who may have other skills and talents that remain untapped to the detriment of the economy and society. Apart from the promise that vocational education will be introduced at secondary level after middle school, nothing has been done in terms of provision of quality non-academic training or apprenticeship. Teachers who have approached us over the past few months have expressed concern over the lack of information given to them about vocational courses they will be expected to manage or teach supposedly from September 2019. The advisory team at the Department of Education has assured teachers that vocational education will become a reality in September 2019, with courses ranging from inherent duties to agriculture. It has come to our attention, however, that the Department of Education has failed to obtain accreditation from the various awarding bodies for these courses and has had to seriously downscale its proposals. Obtaining accreditation from the prestigious examination board is not something that can be done overnight. There is a process. The examination center has two certain criteria and have a proven track record. Likewise, the center needs to have specialists to deliver and assess these courses. Whoever has good governance said it could be done in such a short period of time useless as people. Vocational training needs to be a given, a serious injection of trust to provide an attractive, meaningful, and sustainable avenue of employment for those people wishing to have a trade. There needs to be a balance between academic and vocational education, and for the system to be truly objective and meritocratic. The mental well-being of our students and teachers is very important. Various initiatives have been implemented by the Ministry of Education in the recent past. These are a great start, but we believe that so much more needs to be done. Engaging full school counselors to be the tip of the iceberg. We would like to see up to 15 full-time counselors, one for each school, available for students and teachers alike if the need arises. The government needs to address the issue of excessive assessment from an early age. We need to have a more formative assessment and a less summative assessment, which causes so much stress and anxiety among the young generation. Learning needs to go back to school fun, where possible, and not the objection of dread. Assessment should be a chance to prove that one has learned and not something that keeps you awake at night and causes a panic attack the morning before for fear of consequences of performing badly. We need to address this as well as the workload of our teaching professionals who are burnt out. We need to put the teacher back into the classroom and remove all the unnecessary administrative tasks that we ask them to do. We need to allow them to do what they do best without expecting them also to be gentle trade and drown them with unnecessary tasks for collecting data to track human achievement and behavior, which nobody knows what it is useful or how it enhances teachers and learning now or in the future. Government has to take stock of all this and stop pretending that everything is teaching in education. We need a roadmap, Mr. Speaker, for education for the future. Until these shiny new schools open and are operating, what we need is a clear vision of plan for the next 20 years. It is vital for the well-being of our children, and piecemeal solutions are not the way forward. Together to vote, we will provide this vision in our upcoming manifesto program for government, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, Gibraltar is strong and vibrant. However, we are risking far too much by continuing to delay taking the hard decisions because of a lack of courage and political will to fix what is inherently wrong. We must address our reliance on tobacco that has only deepened during the last decade. We must address a strategy of overdevelopment that benefits the few at the expense of the many. We have to revise a housing policy which leaves huge of property in neighborhoods empty or in decay. We must tighten our economy's reliance on an ever-enlarging civil service. We must deal with cronyism and a chronic lack of transparency and accounting for our borrowing, revenues, and expenditures. We have to overhaul investment and spending practices that our government receives. Self-driving with no leakage to friends and family on the way. We cannot continue to favor investment over maintenance. If something is worth building, it is worth operating and maintaining effectively. It can't be all about cutting red ribbons. We can't continue to brush these burning injustices under the carpet while expecting that the day of reckoning will never come. We need a government and an administration that is prepared to take the hard decisions. We cannot have a government that will continue the status quo and only deepen these problems further, delaying the inevitable and damaging the vote of the own measures. This year marks the 50th anniversary of the border closure, Mr. Speaker. In this event, we remember the pain and suffering that this brutal and arbitrary apartheid inflicted on our community. And we also honor the conviction-driven leaders that were brave and generous enough to set aside their differences in the time of need and work for the common good. There was only one agenda back then, because we were a united, cohesive, and ably represented community. This agenda was the agenda of the common good. The agenda of achieving widespread prosperity, dignified working and housing conditions for all, and most importantly, the survival of our identity and way of life. Today, our political landscape is not more polarized, and our society is not nearly as cohesive. Economic interests coming from near and far have permeated the sphere of power, created a Gibraltar that many in the community have troubled economic growth, albeit an economic growth that very rarely trickles down to the average citizen. In the process, we are dilapidating our most scarce and valuable resource, our limited space, and our general quality of life. Most people in this community today recognize that this economic model has brought disruption, pollution, congestion, and discomfort to their lives, and fail to see the profit of the trader. Many of our constituents begin to envisage a devoted structure with high-rise buildings, luxurious marinas, and fancy real estate development with all the decisions, and they are far from enamored by the season. There can be no progress without provision for equality, sustainability, and the happiness of our people. No economic development merits the deterioration of our quality of life. This year has to save the best for last. Firstly, I'd like to join the other members of this House in extending my condolences to the families of those who have passed on, as Mr. Frank Barber and Ian Lee, two great servants of our community, so I keep hearing, who I unfortunately never had the privilege to meet. I must, however, add to that regrettable list by remembering the wonderful Ruth Dodgers, a true angel who worked tirelessly and assisted everyone she ever could in her department at the tax office and outside of it. Someone is the speaker who has left a massive void in those of us who are not familiar. Mr. Speaker, after four very privileged years serving this community, I would like to thank the members of staff in this building, from Francis to Daniel to Kevin and to the wonderful Paul Martinez, who have never blinked at my requests and needs, big or small, but they always saw with a smile. And to you, Mr. Speaker, I thank you for your unwavering spirit and leadership towards me in my maiden parliamentary term as a member of this House, one which I hope, if the people of the vote so wish, will be a soft term and not a long. And in this vein, I must also thank the Chief Minister himself for having had an open and constructive dialogue with me over the last 4 years, despite us being on opposite sides of the House, providing me with help and assistance as a minority member whenever I was speaking. Never once closing himself off from me just because of the party divide and the sword that we have on many occasions today. Thank you. As the Speaker has already indicated, I'm true to parliamentary convention. I will be voting for the appropriation bill despite my reservations as described in order to signal my desire not to grind services to a halt. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Can I congratulate both of this afternoon's speakers? I think that they have kept us entertained in different ways during the course of their addresses and have made, I think, a fitting end to the fourth session of speeches that this House will have heard in this parliamentary term in the context of the appropriation. I will have a lot more to say in response to all honourable members' opposition. I want to also, in reply this year, reflect a little on some of the things that my colleagues on this side of the House have said to demonstrate, I think, the remarkable hard work that Mr. Wynn has done in the past 4 years. I do think, Mr. Speaker, that in all I have heard from honourable members' opposition, none of them, I think, have doubted the remarkable effort that all of the members of this government have put in the past 4 difficult years. As I said, I will have more to say tomorrow. I propose to come back at 10 o'clock and try and answer all of the questions. Some of them rhetorical, but they won't go without answer. That honourable members have put in the course of their addresses. And if I may say to the honourable lady only this, she was a little disappointing this year. There were no revelations of social media handles, hiding other identities of the sort that we had in the past that might have led us to think that a grand alliance would never be possible. But she has, of course, discharged her obligations as an open citizen very fully and very well able to. So, Mr. Speaker, I would propose that the Honourable Sir Wasana no longer having to stay away from listening to the nonsense that he says that other members opposite doubt that he should be invited to return tomorrow to hear a reply to some of the nonsense we have heard from some honourable members today. The first election will be tomorrow at 10 o'clock. Also, now I turn to tomorrow morning at 10.